The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Andrew.
My name's Andrew. I'm an alcoholic. So my sobriety date is January 21st, 2007. This is my home group. My sponsor's name is Brian G., and I'm working 9 through 12. All right. Can you hear me now? All right. So I'm grateful to be here. This is kind of unfathomable to be standing in front of this room in particular speaking, but let's see how it goes. So I grew up in New Jersey. The only thing I'll mention about my childhood and family life, so January of 1987, my dad was celebrating a year of sobriety and asked the sponsor if he thought he was ready to have another kid. His sponsor said yes, and that's why you have a speaker tonight. So that begun my story with Alcoholics Anonymous. So I come from a long line of alcoholics. I'm just another one. My brother caused a lot of trouble growing up. With his drinking and whatnot. I'll just speak louder. So I was afraid of alcohol, to be honest, most of my childhood. And I never wanted to cause the problems that, you know, I saw my brother causing. And I believed my dad when he told me I was likely to have this thing called alcoholism. Other than that, everything looked normal. On the outside, I did pretty well in school. I played sports. And no one probably would have had any idea that I spent 24 hours a day worrying. Like, I was thinking about that today. Like, I don't know if I had a peaceful, like, moment inside my head until, like, well into my stint in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was just this scared little kid, and it ran my life. So I didn't find alcohol until the end of high school. I went to a high school up on the Upper East Side, commuted there from Jersey, which was a great experience, and I picked up booze my senior year, it was everything I could have ever hoped for. You know, I spent my entire life up to that point in fear of alcohol, and from the first sip, I knew it was everything I needed to live, like, comfortably in this world. That was my drinking career. Nothing bad happened that night. I was blessed with a short drinking career, highlighted by 3 trips to the hospital in the last 5 months of my drinking. I'll only tell one drunk story, because it's the worst of the 3 hospital visits, and I think only an alcoholic could say their worst drunk wasn't their last. So I came to after being in the hospital. I'm covered in blood and urine, and I'm walking into my house after having gone to the hospital. And I walk into my house, and my mom, who, God bless her, had an alcoholic husband, an alcoholic son, and now a third, taking pictures of me saying, "I want you to remember this." And 2 weeks to the day, I was in the hospital again. So it's important for me to share that, because that's how selfish my alcoholism is, and that's how I drink. I can't drink safely. When I pick up a drink, I have no idea what's going to happen, when I'm going to stop. And if I do stop on my own, I have no idea when my alcoholic brain is going to convince me to have another, because I think it'll be okay this time. And that's about as much as I can say about my alcoholism. So I came into AA totally unwillingly. Stephanie just laughed, because I showed up to this room in particular because my cousin, I can't talk about her. I'm going to get emotional. My cousin Amanda got sober at this meeting. And when she saw good old 19-year-old cousin Andrew getting into his trouble, between her and my parents, she dragged me here. And I think that was important. And I remember getting accosted by Stephanie when I walked in the door. And she said hello and was like, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "I'm just checking this thing out." And this month it'll be 11 years. I'm still checking it out. And I can't believe that, and I have no explanation as to how that happened. I have some guesses, and it has to do with the suggestions that people gave me. But I'll walk through, like, at least the beginning of that. I got a sponsor who went to this group. I had a commitment. I had a home group. 5 minutes. Wow, I did a good job getting through the drunk stuff. And I started coming to these meetings, and I started going to meetings in Jersey. That's where I got sober. But I was coming to the city 3 times a week to go to meetings. And I would go to a young people's meeting, and I would come here twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And that became my routine. And believe me, for the first 2 months, I sat in the back. I wanted nothing to do with you people. I didn't open my mouth. That's why I say it's just insane that I'm standing up here. Because I just didn't want to talk to anyone. And if you told me I could have gotten sober without another person, that I could have just read a book and did it on my own, I would have signed up in a second. But it just so happens, my life depends on you guys. And maybe sometimes that's the only reason I do talk to people, but I do talk to people nonetheless. So I started going to the meetings, and I think what happened is I began to identify at some of these meetings. And all that terminal uniqueness I had, that I was too young, that I was too smart, that it wasn't bad enough, that I hadn't drunk long enough, it started to get chipped away at. And I remember raising my hand at a young people's meeting up on the Upper East Side. And I remember, I think I was sitting next to Amanda, and she turned and like looked like, what the heck is he going to say? Like, because up to that point, I hadn't said anything to anyone. And I shared some nonsense. But that was my acceptance and my surrender. And it's been just a ridiculous trip since then. And all it's taken is a daily surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous and to a higher power that's allowed me to stay sober. Because left to my own devices, I am going to convince myself to pick up a drink again. That's just a fact for me, and that obsession will come back. And it has, it's popped into my mind over the course of the 11 years that I've been sober. When I had 9 months sober, I went back to the college that I was at, that I came home from. I was living on campus with a bunch of burgeoning alcoholics, and it was a pretty amazing thing to be sober there. And there were a lot of opportunities to be of service in a unique way, because there were only a handful of us on campus who were sober. But I had a good time doing it and got to go to a lot of basketball games, and that happened to be the site of my last drunk, so that was especially meaningful to get to see some games sober. So I graduated from there. I went to meetings there. I got a sponsor there. And I stayed sober the same way I did in those first 9 months, just because I was in college, didn't affect anything. And life has just, it's just gotten to a point where if I really take a step back and think about, like, my sober life today, it would have been impossible for me to live the life that I'm living right now if I were still the same person that walked in this door. Just absolutely impossible. Bad things have happened, good things have happened. I like to think that I've grown up in AA. From between 19 and 30, a lot has gone down, and I graduated school. I went back to school. I recently moved into the city. That's why it's especially useful for me to be speaking in front of you, so you can get to know me and get to know my story. Because, like I said, my life depends on upon you guys knowing me and me tapping into this resource. So what it's like today, I wake up, I pray, I say, God, please help me handle it, and that's it. Because I don't know what's good and bad for me. I trust in a higher power. I trust in AA to keep me sober. And I trust that this thing works. And I still have a lot of fear in my life. Like I said, because I'm living a life that is just insane to me. I'm working. And the first day of my job that I started in September, they gave this talk, and they said, be fearless and be humble. And that's a tall ask for an alcoholic. You know what I mean? Like, I am neither of those two things. But with AA, I have a shot, and it's given me a chance to live a useful, purposeful life on this earth, and to have relationships in my life that mean something, And it's all due to, you know, the people in this room in particular, my family who knew what to do with a stupid young alcoholic, and my cousin who dragged me to this meeting. And you know, all I can say is that I'm just eternally grateful for a chance at life today because I show up to meetings and receive the help of you good people. Thanks for letting me share.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Emily.
Hi, guys. I'm Emily. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 5th, 2014. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Eleanor R., and I'm working on 9, practicing 10 and 11. My sponsor does not live here, so a lot of my friends joke that, like, I don't really have a sponsor. Like, she's a ghost sponsor. But she is my sponsor. I met with her today. She was in the city. Thank you, Nicole, for asking me to speak. I love this place. This place saved my life. This group, it means so much to me to be here, to do service here. All my friends today are in this room, and that's really just the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I'm surrounded by love 24/7 by the people who I've grown up with in this room. I picked up my first drink when I was 13 years old. I will say there are drugs in my story. I'm grateful for them because they brought me to a bottom quicker than I think alcohol would have. But I was a very outgoing child, but basically that was just anxiety. I was always going like this, flapping my arms. All my teachers would tell my parents at parent-teacher conferences, like, she's just always flapping her arms. Like, I was very anxious all the time about everything. I really just cared what everyone thought about me. I remember in, like, you know, elementary school, I would like, be sad, so I would sit in the corner and cry, but, like, visibly, like, in public place so that, like, someone would come over to talk to me. But once they came over to talk to me, I was like, no, I don't want to talk about it. Like, very, like, dramatic, worried, concerned, upset all the time. By the time I picked up a drink, I thought I really had, like, enough reason to. Like, I was really not happy. I got super drunk. I don't remember anything. I woke up in the morning, got in a lot of trouble, and I was like, wow, I'm going to do this so often. Because I love the effect produced by alcohol, as it says in our literature. Like, that is what makes me who I am, like, in my core. Like, I love being out of reality. I love being obliterated, not having to be present, escaping any feelings I may have currently. And so that's basically how I drank for the next 6 years. This is not my first time getting sober. I started going to psych wards when I was 14. I just could not keep it together. The second I started drinking, my life went really poorly after that. I just was crazy. I could not stay in school. I just had all these erratic behaviors. I tried to kill myself a bunch of times. Nothing was really going well. I was really nice, so I think, like in a lot of situations, so I kind of, like, I played sports, but I was the crazy girl on the weekend. I was the girl that, like, my friends all knew. It was like, make sure if she throws up, it's outside, and keep her shirt on. And that's literally was their, like, two jobs for going to any parties with me. And then I just wasn't invited anywhere after that because they were, like, sick of having to take care of those two things. Because I just wouldn't follow direction. Basically, I had a mental breakdown. I convinced my parents somehow to let me go to college when I was in therapy. I was, like, everything. They were trying to fix me. I was not having it. They pulled me out of high school in 10th grade to come to the city to go to a different high school thinking that would fix it. That didn't do anything. I just found other people to drink with. I found my people to drink with. Alcohol allowed me to breathe. Like, I thought I had never taken a breath in my life. I took a drink, and I was like, oh, like, this is what it feels like to breathe. And so I came to high school in the city. That didn't work out great. I somehow graduated. I'm pretty sure my parents bribed them. I went to college. I lasted 3 months. I didn't know you were supposed to go to class, so I just got drunk and stayed inside. And they were like, you have to, like, do stuff here. And I was like, gotta go. So I just had no interest in that. So I came back here. My dad made me get a job. I started working. I met some cool people to drink with some more. I was miserable. I hated myself. I was doing all these crazy behaviors to try and get out of myself. I hated everything. very upset all the time about something. It could be minor, could be major, didn't matter. I had to be upset about it. So I had a complete psychotic break and got sent to the psych ward. And I basically had been to the psych ward probably like 7 times at that point. So I was like, okay, I go to the psych ward, stay for a couple days, go back home. We're all good. And my parents were like, no, no, like you have a problem. And they were like, you're going to go to rehab. So they found this place online and sent me to a residential treatment facility in Texas that was 9 to 12 months long. And I was like, this is awful. But that was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a really rough period of time in my life. Thank you. Basically, I stayed sober. I went to another rehab after that because I had a lot to work on. And, I basically just, I thought I had it under control, and then I decided that I could drink safely. And so I went out and took a drink after a year and some change, but I had taken a dirty 2-year coin. So if you've ever done that, you're not the only one. I went up, took a 2-year coin and like said, I'm like super sober. If anyone needs help, come to me. And I had been like drinking the day before. So that was rough. But so basically I went in and out and in and out, and I kept hitting these bottoms. And then I realized that I wasn't, like, when I was going out, it wasn't because I thought I could drink safely. I just, like, didn't care anymore. I just hated myself so much, and I was so miserable. What happened was I became homeless within 3 weeks after relapsing again. I just ended up in, I was living out of a motel room. I didn't sleep or eat for 7 days, and I just stayed in there and drank, and was just like, I don't care about anything. My poor father was texting me, and, you know, like, are you alive? And I just wouldn't answer. Finally hit a bottom, went to the hospital. And my parents were nice enough to ship me off to another rehab. And I stayed there for 6 months, and what happened was I had a spiritual experience when I realized that none of this was really, like, I just made everything to be this big thing in my life. Everything was so big and, you know, huge, and, like, basically it was just me and my mind, and it had nothing to do with the person, the place, the thing, the whatever. It was me and my mind and feeling so disconnected from everything and everyone. And I just always felt like I was never enough. I never fit in. I was never a part of. And this is the first place where I ever felt any of those things. And I'm eternally grateful for that. I stayed sober after I got out of rehab. I went to a sober house. I moved back to New York and moved back in with my parents. My experience the last 3 years has been sobriety. It has just been slow. So slow. Oh, my God. Like, I am just a slow version of this. I've made every mistake you can make. I dated in the first year. I just stayed on my 4th step for a year. I was miserable. I came in here and talked to everyone. How do I, you know, get to my 5th step? And they were like, right, your 4th step. And I, like, just could not get it. And basically, this last year has been incredibly difficult. I dealt with a lot of chronic pain where I've had to show up through it, and it's been incredibly hard. In the last 3 months, I've really developed this new relationship with God that I never thought I could have. I always was like, yeah, I believe in God. This is great. Praying and meditating, doing all the actions, working the steps, blah, blah, blah. But, like, in the back of my mind, I was kind of like, I don't know if I really have a God. And basically what happened was I was in this relationship for a year. It was my first relationship ever, basically, because, like, why would anyone want to be with this when I was, like, not doing too well? And I just couldn't maintain a relationship. So I stayed in a relationship for a year. And I had this God moment where I just felt that it wasn't right anymore. I ran it by my sponsor. I took a week to get some clarity, and I ended the relationship, and that was the, like, most, like, God-centered thing I think I've ever done. And the last 3 months has just been transformative in trying to, like, develop a relationship with God, focus on myself, and just, like, I thank God every day for the women in these rooms who have scooped me up when I just felt like I couldn't do it, when I couldn't hold on another minute. I had lost a lot of hope in a lot of the medical problems I've had going on, like having, you know, been in pain every day. I was like, okay, this is never going to end, and I just have to accept I'm in chronic pain. I started doing a new meditation to try and, like, deal with that and accept that. And last week, I went to a new doctor who basically told me he knows exactly what the problem is. He knows exactly how to fix it. And it was, like, the first time in a year and a half of trying to figure this stuff out that anyone's ever said that, and that I actually have felt hopeful about that. And it's because I've continued to show up and take care of myself. I never knew how to call doctors. I didn't brush my teeth for 3 years. Like, I didn't know what you're supposed to do. When I came in here, I had to go to the dentist for, like, 6 months straight every week to get stuff done because I couldn't figure it out. And now I'm, like, going to therapy. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. I have service commitments. I show up. I go to work every day. Weird. I like my job. I contribute to my job. I like my coworkers. Like, I have this beautiful life today. Also, I did not look like this 3 years ago. If you want a picture of what I looked like 3 years ago, it's unrecognizable. This program has done everything for me. God has done everything for me. I'm not like some like guru genius. I don't know what I'm talking about. Like, God has done all of this for me, and I see that today, and that's an incredible experience. For anyone who's new, like, you never have to go through counting days again. You never have to pick up a drink again. Like, you can stay here and hang on to the people next to you. Like, the women in these rooms have saved my life, and I would not be here without them. I have meaningful relationships with people today, with my parents. I got to make amends to my parents. Like, what a concept. I am eternally grateful for this group and for Alcoholics Anonymous and all it has done for me. Thank you so much.
Our main speaker tonight is Richie.
Hi, everybody. My name is Richie. I am definitely an alcoholic. I had to have him move the stand up because I was sitting there and I'm looking at this and I envision myself. I get crazy, falling backwards, knocking everything over on top of the fat kid in front of the room. I vision that happening, and you'll see. I'm sometimes can get a little animated. I have a lot of passion for this thing that we do. So, I'll start out the way I'm always told to start out. Oh, you don't have to worry about that, bro. It's going to get louder and louder. My sobriety date is October 24th, 1996. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. My home group is the Ridgefield Park Young People's Meeting in Ridgefield Park, New Jersey. Tuesday nights, 8:30. If you're ever in town, come by. Look us up. Thank you to the other speakers. It's hard, man, 10 minutes. I'm freaked out. I'm spoiled. Like, when I go around and I'm asked to share my story, a lot of times I get like 45 minutes to an hour. I'm sitting there talking to my wife and I'm like, what am I not going to say, right? And so you start, I could show you my notepad. I'm like, all right, what do I cut out? And then I'm like, this is ridiculous. Aren't you supposed to just go pray and ask God to have you say something? I come here always. Every time I say yes to a speaking commitment, I say yes for the same reason, to the newcomer. And Emily hit on that quite a bit when she was talking, and it really resonated with me, that if it's got a name, it's been done, and you're not alone. And when I share my story and I come up, and I'm going to share some stuff with you guys tonight, I'm a rubber meet the road guy. I like to talk about, I'm a big book thumper, right? I could quote the book page and verse like a preacher if I wanted to. But I find it more helpful to share actual experience that I've had, because experiential sharing can really, it's like the big book. They use a lot of analogies. I'm an analogy guy. Maybe I'm a visual learner, and so I like analogies. And I'm going to talk about a lot of different stuff, and I'm going to squeeze in, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Is rough for me because I could get lost in what it was like. But I will say a few things. First of all, again, when I was sitting there and I came up, I looked at this and I see this devotional box that's up front. Now, I used to joke I'm a recovering Catholic. I was a Catholic school kid for 12 years, an altar boy, the whole nine. And in my church, St. Teresa's, growing up, they had these devotional boxes in the back of the church. And I would come in at like 15 years old to just catch a mass in the middle of the week because I was a good Catholic.
Yeah, right.
I would go to the devotional boxes in the back and look for the foolish old person that put a $5 bill in but didn't quite hit it all the way down. And I would go stand in the back of the church and literally lift the $5 out of the devotional, put it in my pocket, and, you know, walk out of the church. And then when I came into AA and I heard you people saying that God did for you what you couldn't do for yourself and God's the answer, I'm like, well, I'm screwed. I literally picked this pocket I stole from the Virgin Mary and out I went. So when you guys were talking about God being the answer, I was like, well, I'm done, right? But thankfully, it turns out that it didn't matter. So I'm going to give you the best way I can do a Reader's Digest version. There's so many different things that happened to me when I was out there and when I was in my cups. They told me that I can't, I respect the traditions of AA, so I always stick to my alcoholism. But they did say that I can say that drugs are part of my story. So drugs are a big part of my story. And, you know, but it's the reason I mention it is, first of all, I'm given permission, besides the Atlantic Group, but by Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, who both mentioned drug addiction and them using drugs in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if it's good enough for them to mention in our big book, I could certainly throw it out there. But I won't talk specifics because that's not what this place is. And I've got enough alcohol in my story to drown a mule. So, but I will say, I just want to give a picture for the newcomer, because that is part of why we talk about what it was like. I like people to know that I really do know the game and I get it. And I'm a I'm a monster drinker. I'm an addictive personality. Everything I do in massive excess. And when I was out there drinking, I'm a Jack Daniels kid. And I can't tell you how many Christmas trees I knocked over. I can't tell you how many times. Twice I was found out in sub-cold 10 degree or less weather. Once in the Adirondack Mountains, I was found passed out by a fire at 2 o'clock in the morning because one of my friends, thank God, came out to pee outside because he was drunk. Otherwise, I would have been dead. Think about that. And that happened to me more than once. I was found passed out under somebody's car on a dead-end street, under the car. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I probably army crawled under there, and I probably had a reason at the time. I'm not normal when it comes to when I put that stuff in my system. Now, I didn't know what that looked like or meant until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a precursor, and I'll throw it out there to any of the newcomers. I always tell everybody, man, if you don't want to do the steps, don't do the steps. At least do step one. It never hurt you to find out a little bit more about your alcoholism and what that might look like and what it entails. Until I did a first step, I didn't have an answer to any of that stuff. I just thought I was an idiot. But really, there was a lot more involved than that. And so for me, it got worse and worse. Those are the little things. Then came the stealing from my parents and from my dying grandmother. And I can't tell you in the end for me, what it looked like. And alcoholism takes us all to different spots. And we hear people talk about it. You identify, you don't compare, because it doesn't all take us exactly to the same place. But if you listen to speakers, one thing you'll catch is the progression of the illness, how it started, how messed up it got, and how you ended up in the end in a place like this. And if you were well, you probably wouldn't be here. And for me, what that looked like in the very end, I'm a guy who, when I went to my family's house and I went to go calling on them to, you know, borrow money or God knows what I was doing at the time, I'm the guy that when I knock on the door, they would put a chain across the door and open it up and say, "What do you want?" That was me in the end for me. My mom threw me out. My dad threw me out. My sisters certainly wouldn't have me. And the only person that let me stay with them was my bro. And unfortunately for my brother, for about a year and a half, I terrorized him. Not physically, but emotionally. I stole from him. He had padlocks on both sides of his door because I would jimmy the hinges and get in the other way. And it was the fact that he let me stay there as long as he did is absolutely insane. And in the end for me, I became a paranoid maniac who booby trapped his house every day so no one could get in. And I literally covered the windows and I would drink in excess for days on end. And for me, how it got, and I came from a pretty regular family. Like, I went off, my brothers and sisters were annoyingly normal and successful, and I was the black sheep of my family. And to me, in the end, and neighbors and people my family know saw me do stuff like this. But in the end, when I was there, and I was at the very tail end of my story, for me, when I was out partying, I would literally, you would see me at the local 7-Eleven with a brown paper bag, walking around the parking lot and picking up half-smoked cigarette butts. And that's how I would buy my cigarettes, because you know how it is. You know, you got to do what you got to do. I've got to get my smokes. I got to get my booze. I got to get my stuff. And I'm going to do that in whatever it looks like. And literally, family and neighbors would see me in the parking lot. And I always joke, but it's not even a joke. But this is, in the big book, they talk about our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And my alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. What that looked like was, you know what a big monster victory for me was? A monster victory in any given day was in that 7-Eleven parking lot. I would see some Guido in an IROC Z at a red light, and the idiot would light up a Marlboro, take one drag and pull into the 7-Eleven and throw it out the window. I'd be like, yes! And I'd run over and put the cigarette out. It's like a Marlboro. I'm like, monster win! And it goes in the paper bag. And that was a big win for me, you know, collecting my butts. And that's, my life seemed normal to me. Now, normal people, my mother has heard me tell this story, and she's like, I can't believe you did that! Meanwhile, I look around, and I see like 18 to 35 people going, oh yeah, I did that too, for sure. So, now I found myself into detox, right? That's all I'm going to say. I stole from everybody. I was an absolute wreck. You wouldn't have hired me. You would have hid your stuff when I came. People tell the story. Now, I'm the guy that if I would steal your wallet and help you look for it. I wasn't that guy. I would steal your wallet and just go out and party and you'd never see me again. I would never help you look for it. I was a thief and selfish. And so now I go to my family. My brother finally threw me out and said, you can't stay here anymore. In case anybody's confused, if you have no job, no money, no car, no place to live, you're homeless. And homeless sucks, right? I mean, I don't do homeless. I'm not, I know some people can like survive out on the street. I'm just not that kid. So I went to my family and said, I think I have a, you know, problem with alcohol and stuff. And my mother was like, you think so? And they shipped me off to detox. And when I got out of detox, I stood on the front stairs of the detox. There are people in this meeting tonight that will find themselves in this position after this meeting because it's the nature of alcoholism and the way our minds work. There are people who will walk out of here, stand out in front of the building and light up a cigarette and think to themselves, I'm so glad I don't live that way anymore. And I wonder who's around. I wonder who's at the spot. Is Marky Bumps going to pick up if I call him? I wonder who's at the bar, right? And it's the battle of the devil and the angel. And my devil and angel thing was never quite, you know, never really worked out on the right side of stuff. So when I got out of my detox, I didn't think. I just did what they told me to do. And they said, you need to rush to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the moment you get out of this detox and tell them that you're new. So as soon as I started with the back and forth, I just went. And I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out of detox. AA is not a hotbed of mental health. I mean, and I'm top amongst them, and you're going to hear my first story about my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's crazy sometimes the stuff that's happened to me in my recovery. And I'll tell you my first meeting of AA. I walk into this meeting, and there's all old people in their 40s, right? That's how I looked at it back then. You know, they're all old, you know? So I walk in and there's 40 deep in Staten Island in this meeting and they're all, you know, sitting around and I'm like, I don't want to be there at all. See, I'm not one of these guys who came into AA and is like, AA just circled me and surrounded me. Hell no. I identify with you guys. Like, I had no interest in being here at all. I kind of had to be, but I'm an eye roller, a skeptic, a doubter. I'm a complainer. I came in angry. I had rage issues. So I walk into this meeting and I'm just like, whatever. And I go sit down and they told me to do it. So I raise my hand and I'm like, yeah, I'm Richie, alcoholic, I guess. And I just got out of detox and I look down at my shoes for the rest of the meeting. It's an interesting thing, right? Eye contact. I looked at my shoes for my whole life when I was out there using. I would never look you in the eye when I spoke to you. Now I look people in the eye today, but back then, no. I just stared at my shoes for the entire meeting. Now, after I shared, does everybody know cross-talking rules? Apparently they didn't have any at this meeting because everyone talked about me. And I'm sitting there and, you know, you'd think it would be endearing, right? They were all like, and to the young man that just got out of detox, I'm like, oh, another one after the other. And, you know, I'm thinking, move on, man, move on. You know what I mean? Because I'm done. And the more they talked about it, the more annoyed that I got. So my first meeting, I sat there just angry, looking at my shoes. Finally, thank God, this interminable meeting was over after like 4 hours. It was 50 minutes. It was 4 hours, it felt like. So now it's over, and I'm like, I got to get out of here. And I literally, they say the prayer. I get up, and the guy who ran the meeting comes over, and he's like, I'm so glad you came. Wait a second. We got to give you a meeting list with everybody's names on it. And I'm like, yeah, okay, great, man. Thanks. You know, nice meeting list with everyone's names that I'll never call ever for anything. I'm like, okay, I'll wait for that. Every person came. They almost lined up like I was the speaker to come over and say, listen, good luck. And people are coming up, and they're like, keep coming back. And everybody's patting me. And I'm like this, like, I don't want anybody touching me, right? I'm just at a detox, man. Personal space. And everybody's patting me on the back. And again, you would think when we tell these kinds of stories that I had this, like, you know, this God moment where they all cared about me. Hell no! I just was like this. Finally, the guy gives me the meeting list. All the people finally left, and I'm able to get out of there. And I'm looking at the meeting list that I'm never going to call. And some guy, and I saw him in my peripheral vision. You know, I've got that sound and peripheral vision from being out there. You know, like if you opened your sock drawer, I know that's the one you kept your money in, and I just took 40 bucks and I hear it squeaking and I'm out the door. And I see this character and he's hanging around over here and he comes and walks over to me. And this is Staten Island AA and he goes, hey, kid. And I said, yeah. And he says, you see the name right there, Jimmy, the one with the asterisk next to it? And I'm like, yeah, I see it. And he goes, you call that number. And I said, yeah, all right, Jimmy. And he goes, no, you don't understand. You called that number. And I said, yeah, okay, thanks. You know, mental note, never call Jimmy, right, for anything. Then I said, all right, Jimmy, yeah, thank you, man. I'll call the number. And he goes, I don't think you get it. He said, let me explain something to you, kid. 2 hours from now, 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, you're going to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're going to be dying for a drink. And when you do, you call that number. And I said, yeah, all right, Jimmy. And he said, I'll tell you something else. If it is 2 o'clock in the morning and my wife answers, you tell that B-I-T-C-H to wake me up. I'm just at a detox, right? I mean, end of the story. I never called Jimmy, obviously, for anything, right? But my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, much of it, is a looking back thing. And I didn't realize what I walked into that day. What I walked into was power unlimited. Because you know the thing about that guy, Jimmy? He meant every word he said. That's the power of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would have woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning. He doesn't even know me. He would have gotten his shoes on, gotten in his car, picked me up wherever I was, brought me to a diner and sat with me for 4 hours until the urge passed. Where do you find that power? Nowhere in the planet do you find that other than this place. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just a small example of what you walked into here. Big Book. Staten Island, growing up, the Big Book, there was like division. There were Big Book people and then the sick and suffering meetings. Just calling them that makes you sick and suffering. Do you not see that? Well, I was one of those people at some point. 15 minutes, I got you, bro. He said, you have to acknowledge the sign. Otherwise, I'm going to keep going like this until you point to me. So I'm good, brother. I'm good. The difficulty is that my brain is so broken that I have no idea what I was going to say. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anyway, I'll just move on because I think everybody gets the point of what I'm trying to say. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we have. That's what we found. Never called Jimmy, but I called a lot of other people. And you guys saved my life and you surrounded me. And there is no division because the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, those little coins we get when we celebrate, they have deep meaning. Unity, service, recovery. Unity is monster important for me. Commitments, Alcoholics Anonymous. Keeping the light on, man. You know what I mean by keeping the light on? These are the people that do the work. All the people that take the commitments at this monstrous meeting. The guy who takes the little coffee commitment at my meeting, yeah, that's great. He shows up and whatever. This place ain't a light. It's a lighthouse. It's a monstrous light in the world of addiction and alcoholism. It's crazy cool that you guys have this here. Now, in this church right now, there's a lot of newcomers. I know, because I can feel you guys, man. I can just see it and feel it. God, I love the newcomer because you keep me alive, man. And so, and I'm gonna give a little warning. I like the metaphors. I like the little stories because it's stuff that I can remember. And it really summarizes us very well, as far as I'm concerned, and a place like the Atlantic Group. And the Atlantic Group, let's pretend for a moment, and I know you guys have sat up at 3 o'clock in the morning watching National Geographic, the plains of the Serengeti, right, when the lions are eating the zebra and all that. You guys, I know most of you probably done it. That is a really good analogy for this place. Because the watering hole in the plains of the Serengeti, very dangerous place, right? It's like the concrete jungle right outside these doors. And there are lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And they are looking to grab hold of the alcoholic, right? And drag him into the woods. What this place is the watering hole. And that's the source. That's the power that these people bring, the Big Book, the recovery work that they do here. And you're ushered into this place, and you got a bunch of the old-timers, the old zebras. And if you really look at those National Geographic shows, they got the zebras. They're all standing on the outside of the watering hole. They're all mangled. You can see their backs with claw marks that have healed. Those are the old-school ones that realize that when the lion comes up, you got to kick the hell out of him, and you can break his jaw, and they'll leave you alone. Now, the new zebras, they don't know anything. So we tell them, all right, come on, get in front. You know what I mean? Go to the waterhole, go to the source, and we got your back. And we'll surround you, because that's what we do in a place like this. We surround you, and we got your back. And you come in, and you get with us, and we got you. And what does the newcomer do? Because there are a lot of moronic zebra in the Serengeti. And the handful of moronic zebra in here right now, I have no doubt. And what do? You do what I would do. You start, and you're hanging out, and you're like, this is great. And then you're like, look at that. Just over there, a little watering hole, but it's kind of, I could do it by myself. And I'm going to just wander over there and check that out and see what that's all about. And all the old zebra are like, excuse me, you don't want to go over there? Oh, I got this, doggy. You know, I got this, right? Newcomer, I got this. And they're saying, listen, you may not want to, okay, nothing. You know, we can't make you do it. And all of a sudden, they're grazing on their own, and maybe one other even goes and joins them, the other rocket scientist, right? And they're both over there. And all of a sudden, they spot another one a little bit further out, and they notice that it's even shady. And they talk themselves in like it may be a little more dangerous, but we'll be okay. Before you know it, they're right over by the edge of the woods, and all the old-timers are saying, bro, you gotta get out of there. And you know what happens? And it grabs them by the neck and drags them into the woods. Right? Blood everywhere. And what do? The old zebra, they look over, and they're like, oh, my God. And then they just turn back to the watering hole. Because, right? That's the reality of what we are and what we do, right? Because, you know, the plains of the Serengeti are very much like the concrete jungle out here. And we have that source and we have that power and we will surround you and we will protect you if you care to have what we shall freely give. So now, that's a really good picture as far as I'm concerned of someone like me. I am the moronic zebra. Thankfully, I wasn't killed and dragged into the woods. Having said that, now what I really want to talk about are watershed moments in recovery. Because I could share 1,000 things that have happened to me over 21 years. I never know what I'm going to tell when I come to talk to people because I've had stuff that has been rock star for me. When I did finally go to my second meeting of AA, I met my sponsor. Sponsorship is everything. If you're somebody who's just coming in, don't drinking, going to meetings, coming in, you know, kind of by osmosis, you listen to everybody share, and I got my juice, I got my energy for the day, or whatever you say. Listen, the fellowship is awesome, but in and of itself, by itself, the big book warns about it. The fellowship by itself is not enough. And what we need is a recovery experience because your lifestyle stinks and you need a replacement lifestyle. And that's what we can give you here. And you can go through a series of clear-cut directions to have an experience. And there's sponsors that can help you do that. And if you're not hooking up with a sponsor, you should think about it because these are the people that can show you the guideposts to have an experience. I was lucky that I found my Ebbie Thatcher in that second meeting I went to and he guided me through my recovery program. Now, I can't share everything. I can't tell you, you know, all those years worth of amazing experience. But I will tell you that they told us in Staten Island, don't know if they talk about it here, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Anybody ever hear that? Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. When's the miracle? Tell me where it is. When is the miracle? I mean, it's stupid when you're a newcomer. You're like, what miracle? Well, it's different for everybody. And I didn't know when my miracle was going to be. And so I'll share with you my miracle. This is what happened to me. There's a lot of morals in this little story I'm going to tell you, and one of them is that I am so used to managing my own life, I managed myself into a disastrous dead end of misery and horror and hopelessness in my life, and I'm a bad manager of my life. And when I came into here, that was the, you know, that was the beginning of me either still continuing to try and manage my life or to turn my will and life over to something else. And so when I came in and I met with Joe T and I start having my experiences, I'm doing all this cool stuff and I'm starting to grow and I'm starting to change. And then it got a little stale and I went through a little back and forth as we do when we first come in here. And then I got stuck and I started having drink dreams again. And I'd had those in the beginning when I first came in. And if anybody tells you that that's totally normal because you're alcoholic and you should have drink dreams, it's total nonsense. If you're fantasizing about something that could literally derail and kill you, that's bad, right? I'm sorry. That's a warning sign from the universe that you better get busy and do something. So I went to my sponsor and said, I'm starting to have drink dreams again, man. And he was like, yeah, well, you know, when was the last time you made an amends? When was the last time you did this? And so I sat there and looked at this man who was an amazing guy. And he's done a lot of this work and he's helped me incredibly. And I looked him dead in the eye and I said, well, as far as the amends go, I said, you know, I don't have any real amends left. And he was like, well, what do you mean, any real amends? And I said, you know, I just got the BS ones. And he's like, what's a BS amends? So I don't even know what that means. He's like, you have a list of amends that you have to make or not? And I said, yeah, but the ones I got left are all just nonsense. And he's like, well, humor me. Tell me about some of the nonsense amends that you have, you know? And I'm serious when I'm telling him this stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, dude, look at this. And now I'm getting sarcastic as I do when I get defensive. And I'm like, all right, Joe, yeah, okay, these are the big ones that are going to make the dreams go away, right? This is going to be the one, Savon, I stole a curling iron, right, when I was 14. I don't know why I would steal a curling iron. I have no idea. But I did stuff like that. I stole a curling iron, like, for $8. Like, oh, that's going to be the one, I told him. You know, put me over the top, and I'm being an idiot. And he's hearing me out. And then I finally found the one, and I said, oh, this is the one, Joe. This is the big one, man. This is the one that's going to do it. And I'm like, when I was a paper boy, when I was like 11, I double collected from this family, the D's. I know I'm not allowed to use their last name, so I remember that too. And I double collected from these poor people, and I lied to the husband and wife back to back weeks because I'm so stupid. I literally lied to him and then her within 7 days, double collected. Oh, you forgot to pay me, and you forgot to pay me. And they gave me the money. $4.50 I owed these people. That's the one, right? $4.50. I gotta go give the D family up on my old paper route, and that's gonna get me sober. And my sponsor heard me out, and he just said, Richie, listen to me. You are insane. He's like, you're sitting here and you're telling me you don't want to go make this amends, and it's a ridiculous amount. It's a small amount of money. They're not going to still live there. They'd never recognize who you are. These are all nonsense excuses. You're insane. He's like, you told me from the beginning that you are willing to go to any lengths. Has that changed? And I'm like, whatever. And he's like, no, seriously, has that changed? I'm like, fine. And he goes, do you know what willingness is? If anybody's sitting in here, I'm going to ruin some stuff for some people up in the Atlantic group right now. If you tell me that you've got unfinished amends, but you're willing to make them, you ain't. Because if you were, you wouldn't have unfinished amends. Willingness has a sound, and it sounds like this. And that means you knocking on someone's door. And that's what my sponsor told me. Don't talk about willingness. Go knock on the lady's door. I'm like, fine. I said, I'll put $4 in an envelope, and I'll go knock on the door. And he goes, $20. You know, they made us interest. My sponsor firm is annoying. You got to compound interest, $20. I'm like, all right, fine. So I take the $20, and I put it in an envelope, and I go drive to this family's house. I remember my paper out. Still, to this day, I know where everybody was. The family names, it's crazy. 5 minutes, I got you, bro. So I go, and I drive to these people's house, and as I always say, I get there, and I'm all of a sudden, I'm scared, because I made a lot of amends, but I don't know why. This ridiculous amends just seemed fear had come back in, which it can for us. And the sound of willingness to me wasn't what I sounded there. My sound of willingness was like this. You know what I mean? And because what I was looking to do is hit up a light knock on the door and then get out of there, drop it in the mailbox, spiritual amend, you know, universal, and then I'm gone, right? Jump back in my car, and away I go. But it wasn't to be, because I light knocked on the door, and whoop, the door opens, and there she is. And I recognize her. And I'm like, oh my God, it's her. And she's like a little Irish Spitfire, total silver hair now. And I look at her, I'm like, oh my God, that's her. And I'm like, hi. And she goes, oh my God, it's Richie Hessian, the paper boy. And I'm like, now think about what I'm saying, right? My AA experience is like a movie. You couldn't make this up if you tried. And I'm like, oh my God. And so I'm like, oh, hey, Mrs. D, how are you? She's like, come in. I'm like, no. You know, I'm going to hit this up on the stairs and get out of here. And so I'm like, no, I'm good. And so she says, no, nonsense, come in. And she hooks my arm and drags me into her house. Now, I go in these people's living room from 18 years earlier when I was 11, and there on the couch is her husband, this mountainous Irishman, Mr. D. Have you ever met a mountainous Irishman? They're 7 feet tall, hands like basketballs. Hello, Richard. And I'm like, I felt like a little boy again. Hey, Mr. D. Now it occurs to me that I'm standing in the living room of two people that I had stolen from when I was a little boy, wrote their name, not sure how it came out, and here they are right in front of me, both of them in their living room. And I'm like, oh, my God, what do I do? And Mrs. Dunn says, Tommy, Jimmy, Richie Hessian's here. And I'm like, no. She calls the kids. Tommy comes from the kitchen. Jimmy, who's a stoner from my neighborhood with a really long beard at this point, comes walking down the stairs by the banister. And he's like, what's up? And I'm like, hey, what's up, Jim? And now the whole family's staring at me. And she goes, so what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, what do you say? So I didn't know what to say, so I said what you guys taught me to say, and it went overdrive, and I said, you may or may not know this, but I'm a 12-step recovery program, victory over alcoholism. One of the things I did, make a list of people I'd harm. Your name came up on the list. I double collected. I lied to you and I lied to you, and here's $20 with interest, and I'm really sorry. And I looked down at my shoes. I hadn't looked at my shoes in 2 years. Down to the shoes I went. Total silence. Mrs. Dunn walks over to me. She takes my chin. She lifts my eyes so I would look at her in her eyes. And she said, Richard, we knew you took that money and lied to us all those years ago. She said, but we just figured maybe you and your family were going through a hard time and you needed the money. And so this lady, I realized that she let me steal from her and hers because she thought maybe I was having a tough time. Did you know there were really people like that out on planet Earth, man? Because I didn't. And I got to tell you, man, that rocked me. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. I wasn't even going to make that ridiculous amends because I know what's good for me. I know which ones are going to be important, the watershed stuff, because I'm great at managing my life. Look how well I've done. Thank God I stopped that nonsense when I came here and I had sponsors to tell me, you don't get to decide that. You do this. And so I went forward, followed directions, made the amends that I would never have made, and it lit me up like a pinball machine. And I mean a switch flipped on, man. All of a sudden, I knew God. I knew God in a way I'd never known God before. I didn't walk out of that house. I floated. They all hugged me. Stoner Jimmy came down, man. The whole family hugging on me in the living room. It lit me up. I had a real spiritual experience in those people's house that day. It changed the course of my existence here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know why? Because I didn't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens, and because I don't get to decide what's right for me and what's good for me in my life. So, I have 1 minute, right? A lot of times I nail that perfect, right, at the end of that story, and I have another amends story I wanted to tell, but now I'm not going to be able to. Thanks a lot. Having said that, there is no better way to end than a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when you're sharing and you're talking to people, and I am talking to the newcomer because that's why we're here. This stuff is pure magic. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I've never had an experience like this in my life. I am a doubter, a skeptic. I had no interest when I came in here. I am an absolute whack job. I've got so many other, it's like whack-a-mole with me, even in my recovery. But the thing is, this thing is bigger than all of us. I'm going to tell you something, and if anybody hasn't told it to you, and I'm going to, there's the doubting God, belief in maybe the possibility of God. Oh my God, I have faith in God. And then you can peek behind the curtain in Oz and realize that God is real. The stuff we're talking about is real. It's rock star, and it can be here for you. Thanks for letting me come and share.